Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller, and we're going to spend the next 45 minutes or so talking with you about a new book. It's called Our Living Ancestors, The History and Ecology of Old Growth Forests in Wisconsin and Where to Find Them. John Bates back once again to visit with us, and I'm really glad to have him along today. He's the author of 9 books, a contributor to 7 others. He's worked as a naturalist in Wisconsin's North Woods for 29 years. And it's wonderful to be able to see this book and read it. And for me, I've spent most of my adult life, I think outside of a year, I have lived in the state of Wisconsin, except for 1 year. And for all of my adult life, I have spent time pretty much, I would say 98% of those years, I have spent in the visiting the Shawamigan National Forest. And a piece of that forest, I think you can call an old growth forest. But I learned a lot in reading John's book about forests and old growth forests. And I think you will, too, when you have a chance to take a look at it. And so we'll talk with him about the forest and about his book, and certainly take your questions as well. Do you have a favorite forest in Wisconsin, one you might consider to be an old-growth forest? Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. John Bates joins us by phone today. John, thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Larry, thanks for inviting me on.
It's always a pleasure.
When
is a forest considered old growth, or when do you consider one old growth?
Well, you've asked the impossible question because forests vary so much in species composition. So an old growth white pine forest, for instance, might be considered getting old growth characteristics by 150 years old. But species vary. So an aspen forest, which we have so much of in the North Woods these days, an old aspen is 80 years old, dies usually by 100 years. So it depends on the species. White pine can live 250 to 400 years as an average life expectancy, and up to 500 years. So what I've learned about the definition of old growth is that it's a political definition. It varies from state to state. It varies from national forest to national forest. But what all these definitions have in common are a series of characteristics that I'll fly through real fast. These forests generally have old trees. How old is old is always a question. They have all aged species composition. So post-settlement, when surveyors came through, they found over two-thirds to three-fourths of Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin, was old growth, but that means a third to a fourth wasn't. It was in various stages of regrowth from natural disturbance and from Native American alteration of the forest. So we had younger forests growing up within the older forest. So a true old growth forest will have canopy gaps and have a bunch of younger stuff coming up. It'll have a lot of decaying older trees, which, interestingly enough, are really, really important. We tend to think of trees getting old and dying as going to waste, but in an old-growth forest, it's exactly the opposite. Decay and dying of trees is hugely important to the overall ecosystem of an old-growth forest because they provide all these functions, which we can talk about later. And there's multiple layers and big trees, but big doesn't always equate to age, so it's complicated. An example of big not equating to age is our oldest trees in Wisconsin are white cedars that are growing on the Niagara Escarpment, and they're just little tiny things growing out of the side of the escarpment in Door County and some of the more southern counties with the escarpment running through it, and some of those trees are 600-plus years old. The oldest one on record living is up into Ontario in the Niagara Escarpment, but it's over 1,300 years old. So,
wow.
And these are tiny. I mean, they are a few inches in diameter oftentimes, but they can't get any bigger because they'll fall off the side of the cliff face. So, size doesn't equal age. So you can't necessarily just look at a forest and say, oh, this is old growth, because it just doesn't work that way visually. You have to combine all these kind of characteristics.
I can remember walking in the Shawamigan National Forest and coming on a white pine that somehow survived.
Yeah.
It was an absolutely beautiful, enormous tree. And I at the time I wondered, man, what must it have been like way back when there were thousands and tens of thousands of these enormous white pines in the state?
Yeah, wouldn't it be something?
Wouldn't it be something?
Yeah, get in that time capsule and go back 150 years and see what it was. It would be remarkable because we have so few of those big white pines left. The statistic that I have been working with is white pines over 150 years old, somewhere around only 1,000 acres left. So that's less than 2 square miles. Very little old growth white pine left. But when you do see a 4-foot diameter white pine, that gives you a sense of what we had. And even then, it's only a minor sense. John Curtis, in his seminal book, Vegetation of Wisconsin, every botany student reads in a freshman botany class, talked about 5 to 7 foot diameter white pines as being not necessarily common, but around with frequency and 400 plus years old. So we just don't see those anymore. They're such a gift when you do see them.
Oh, it was just stopped me in my tracks.
It's almost a spiritual experience.
You wonder, boy, what is this tree seeing? This tree, you know, is going to be long after, you know, it came long before me and will be there long after me unless something happens to it.
Isn't that the truth? Yeah, it kind of brings all that history alive. Michelangelo and folks like that 500 years or so ago were alive when this tree was alive. That's really remarkable to consider.
And, you know, there are, I guess, moral reasons in some ways for wanting to preserve them, but there are many reasons, to want to preserve these old growth areas that we have.
Yeah, gosh, there's a ton of values. And, you know, one value is utilitarian. We can do selective cutting and old growth. The Menominee Forest folks do that and do it as well as anybody in the entire world. So we can still derive economic benefits. But there's a host of other ones. One that I think is real interesting is just as a genetic reservoir. These oldest trees have lived through everything we've thrown at them so far, and their DNA might very well be just what's needed to survive what we're still throwing at them. So there's that. There's just the whole biodiversity that's involved in these very old communities. There's the science of it. Well, how do we know what's normal when we're managing forests if we don't have a benchmark, if we don't have a reference or a gold standard to go by to look at and say, this is what the natural world was doing before we showed up and started our forestry practices, and how can we mimic that as best we can while still utilizing some utilitarian values? There's a bunch of recreational and scenic values, wildlife values, and to me that reverential, spiritual kind of value is also very large. I lead lots of hikes into old growth, and there's everyone's breath, you know, it just kind of goes out when they walk into one of these places, and you just say, oh my goodness, this there's that sense of peace and that great sense of humility of these very old beings that you're now amongst. That's a priceless thing.
Yeah, it is. It is indeed.
Yeah.
Lois in Milwaukee has a question or comment. Lois, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. My grandfather bought land, and he bought it from a homesteader near Eagle. It's the Studi something else trail. It abuts Old World, Wisconsin. It's in the Southern Kettle Moraine. And it was forested when he had it. I'm wondering if any of those areas are considered old forests.
I'm not familiar with that specific area, to be honest.
The Kettle Moraine area.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the Kettle Moraine, but the specific site within it. There's a lot of that oak savanna kind of country down that way. I don't know if that was oak savanna. The removal of Indians onto reservations changed all that fire dynamics down there, and you end up with a lot of trees that are 150, 200 years old coming up now that fire's been removed from the landscape. I'm sorry, I don't know specifically that site. I spent 15 years wandering this crazy state looking for everything I could, but I did not find any specific site in the Southern Kettle Moraine that met at least my definition of old growth, but I'm aware that I could have missed all kinds of stuff. So.
There you go. Thanks, Lois, for calling. And stay listening. Mike in Madison, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I wonder if you could possibly say something about the Pestilwell Fire, you know, that has such historical importance in Wisconsin, the reason why it happened, and
sure.
Whether there's any markers, you know, that on the ground that today because of that fire.
You have a nice piece on fire in your book, but go ahead and comment on this specific.
Yeah, I do. I talk a lot about the Holocaust fires they're referred to from the 1870s to the 1920s or so. You have to think back to what we were doing. We were cutting as fast as we could because wood was in the way of small farms and this whole Jeffersonian idea of taking this so-called wilderness and making it into small farms for people to live on. So we were doing the Homestead Act and the Preemption Act and so forth and trying to get people on the landscape, and they were cutting as quick as they could, and they needed to get all that slash off of the land so they could plant, and the fastest way to do that was with a match. So the axe was the right hand, the match was the left hand, and we set fires like crazy. And so the Pestilwell Fire in particular, 1871, my recall of that is four or five different fires coming from different directions and coalescing in this tornado of fire, 1,800 people or so dying, some estimate probably 2,500 because the winds and the fire were so intense that some people were simply, they say, vaporized.
Vaporized, yeah.
Yeah, so just astonishing power of fire. So we had fires on the landscape endlessly for 50 years. And it was kind of the pillar of civilization is how it was looked at. It was looked at favorably because it was clearing the land so that we could farm it.
Yeah, and you know what? We're going to keep talking about that, Mike and John. I know you've got more to say about it. We'll take a quick look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back with our guest, John Bates, author of Our Living Ancestors. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. On Wednesdays, we always take a look at outdoor and environmental kinds of issues. We've been doing just that with our guest, John Bates. John is the author of the book titled Our Living Ancestors, How History and or the History and Ecology of Old Growth Forests in Wisconsin and where to find them. So where you can find them and take a look at them. You can join in with your own questions. Do you think it's important to protect these old growth lands? Love to hear from you. Maybe some experiences of your own that you'd like to share about the forests of Wisconsin. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And John, before we broke for the news, you were talking, sort of answering a question that Mike from Madison posed about the effects or the Pestilwell Fire itself and how it might have affected the current forest.
Yeah, so it's a bigger issue than the Pestilwell Fire. That was the first big Holocaust fire. There were just many, many after that, and I write about it in the book. Because, again, it was a means to clear the land. And those fires were also part of, wood was the way. So we were cutting down a lot of wood simply to build fences, to build farms, for roads, for a host of things. So wood was in the way and wood was the way. And so we're just cutting it down as fast as we could and torching it purposely. Almost 50% of the fires, the ecologists say, were set by settlers. Others were set by trains going through without spark arresters on the smokestacks, you know, just a whole lot of ways we were starting fires. We had all the slash all over everywhere. So the fires really changed ecologically the face of the Northwoods in particular. Most of the Northwoods burned and may have burned several times depending upon that different site. So, man, it was there had to be smoke in the air just about every year for 50 years or so till we finally got fires under control in the 1930s.
I was in that section of the book, if I'm remembering it right, you were talking about, you mentioned Gifford Pinchot,
right,
who was a wonderful environmentalist, but who failed to see the value of downed trees.
Right. And so we still have in many places in our culture this sense of wood being allowed to decay and to die and to fall as waste and certainly from a commodity standpoint, that's true. I worked as a carpenter and I burn wood and I use wood in a lot of ways. So from that commodity aspect, yes, it's a waste. But from an ecological aspect, absolutely not. We have 30 species plus of birds that are cavity nesting birds, so they need old and decaying trees to put their nests in. The one that's so common up here, black-capped chickadees, are cavity nesters. So you need an older tree that they can, usually a white birch, that they can pull out that punky interior. We have 30-plus birds that nest on the ground, and so they need all that coarse woody debris that's branches and trunks falling down on the ground. They provide cover for those birds to tuck their nests into. Just oodles and oodles of value to dead and dying trees. And there are some ecologists that will say that dead trees provide more life-giving properties or contain more life, as it were, than while they're living. One thing that I always look for in nurse logs, when a tree falls down in a northern hemlock hardwood forest, it takes 200 years or so for, a hemlock to decompose. And while it decomposes, it gets covered with moss, and it's this great site for these tiny seeds of hemlock and yellow birch in particular to fall on these old decaying logs, and which hold the moisture because of all that moss, and then they can germinate and withstand drought periods in the summer and get a going. Yeah. That is, in the woods. And sometimes when you're in a woods, you find these straight lines of trees, old growth trees, and you say, "Who planted that?" Well, that was a big mama grandmother tree that fell down, maybe 150 feet long white pine that has now decayed, and you have this straight line of trees growing on what was formerly a nurse log.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Tim in Hancock has a question for you. Tim, hi.
Hello, and I appreciate your taking my call. My question is, what happens when, like, 80 to 100-year-old forests, old oak forests, like are prevalent in central Wisconsin, are cut down through contemporary logging practices? I'm aware of a spot that is almost a mile-long stretch in extremely hilly terrain, glacial terrain, where the old growth, like 80 year and older, and I don't know if this meets the definition, oak trees have been cut down in a pattern that would look like an oak savanna. But how does that affect the environment, especially when it's done on hilly, sandy soil?
Right. So if you have hills, you certainly don't want to cut too heavily because it'll be erosive. Foresters are pretty darn good these days at understanding all those processes and trying to match a forestry technique with what they're trying to get to grow and to make sure that ecological processes aren't harmed. So there's best management practices. You know, I don't know that particular site, but certainly on hills you want to be very careful. It may be a shelterwood cut where they're leaving numbers of older trees to seed in with acorns, trying, because red oak needs some sun to get going. It doesn't need full sun, but it needs some sun so it can tolerate a little shade here and there. That may be what they're trying to encourage, is regrowth of oaks while at the same time taking out a valuable commodity. So that'd be my best understanding of what probably is taking place there.
And Tim, thanks for calling. You know, I want to step back, or go back, I guess I should say, and have you go over your book and what you cover in your book, because, well, you're such a wonderful writer, just to begin with. But tell us about the way you've got your book organized.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, the first chapter is entitled "How We Got Here." So, how did we end up with only 0.2% or so of upland forests in old growth? So we cut and burned 99.8% of our upland forests. So the question is, why did we do that? How did that happen? And so telling stories about that, I try very hard in the book to write a narrative story so that you can follow it and enjoy it and not just have it be a whole bunch of science that's over folks' heads. The second chapter is about definitions, because, you know, how old is old, how big is big, how disturbed is disturbed, how pristine is pristine, how much is enough, all those kinds of impossible questions. Third chapter is about ecology, how old growth works. Fourth chapter is values. We talked earlier about some of those values, wildlife values in particular. And I do an inventory in the fifth chapter. What did we have? What do we have now in various forest communities? And in chapter six, I finish up with a vision for what we could do if we wanted to restore some of that old growth. And then the last two chapters are the 50 best old growth sites that, in my very humble and extremely humble estimation, still are on the landscape, and then the 50 best of the rest. So I identify 100 different sites folks can walk into and at least see mature two old growth trees as part of that particular community, and there are maps for those 50 best old growth sites and directions on how to get there and descriptions of what you might expect once you show up. Unfortunately, a number of those sites don't have trails in them, so I tried hard, though, to make sure there was at least a parking area and a state natural area sign or whatever it might be to identify the site. And so sometimes you're on your own. You got to do a little bushwhacking, or you got to find the old trails or the old forest roads, because there's almost no relic sites in Wisconsin. Fundamentally, we dipped our hands into just about everything there was. A lot of the old growth sites that are the best had the pine high graded out, and they left the hardwoods and the hemlocks because they didn't float down the rivers and whatever reason didn't get back to them. So that's how the book's organized.
And it is a compelling story the way it reads. I really enjoy reading it. Tim in Oregon has something for us. Then we'll get to Brianna in Wausau. Tim, what's on your mind?
Hi. First, I'd like to say I agree with you, Larry, that John Bates is really a great nature writer. Excellent books in the past, and I'm looking forward to reading his new one. Next, I was once considered a member of an informal group we call the Wisconsin Big Tree Society. We looked for and cataloged the largest tree of every species at that time. This was in the 80s and 90s, 1980s and 1990s. the leader in that effort to find the big trees and recognize them was the Wisconsin DNR. There was an assigned forester department fellow who helped us keep track of things, and the DNR even maintained a accessible register of where the biggest individual trees were. I think the top 10 of every species were listed. And I think maybe the comment I'd like to make is that once we know where the big trees are, we know where the oldest trees are, and if they can be recognized and somehow protected, even informally, we will someday have more old growth that we can visit. And in particular, we found that most of the big trees that we identified were on public land, but private landowners seem very interested in the recognition and the acknowledgement that they have a tree that could one day be the state champ, and that we hoped would lead to preservation.
Oh. Tim, thanks for calling. John, a comment.
Yeah, I'm well aware of those big tree lists. I don't know if that's currently maintained by the DNR. Hopefully we'll get back to maintenance of that list, that people can contact someone and work to identify maybe some other newer trees, because these guys get old and fall down. Then what's the next best on the list? Or maybe there's some we haven't identified yet. And there's lots of great technology to use in determining now the height of a tree and so forth. You know, in the book, I tried to be very clear about not identifying individual trees, but rather trying to identify forest communities of old growth. Because if someone can grow in their yard with fertilizer and all the full sun of their yard, some pretty darn big trees, but that's certainly not a forest. And in a city park or something like that, we can grow big trees, but again, that doesn't have all those characteristics of old growth we talked about before. So what I was trying to do in particular was focus on larger areas that had probably a small component of old growth, but had some other maturing trees, the 80 to 100 second growth that were cut at the turn of the 20th century there and 19th century, and have potential for becoming much larger if we have a lighter hand on them.
If we have a lighter hand on them. Thank you, Tim, for calling. Brianna in Wausau, now it's your turn. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just calling because I am listening to you guys talking about the old-growth forests. My husband and I discovered something interesting about them this year when we learned about mushroom foraging and mushroom hunting for medicinal mushrooms and mushrooms that you can eat and prepare. And that's been pretty interesting. And it's amazing to find out how many anti-cancer mushrooms and super medicinal mushrooms live in old-growth forests on decaying wood. Particularly hemlocks. In fact, this past summer, we went out to an old-growth forest and found a bunch of hemlock trees and wound up walking out with 25 pounds of reishi mushrooms, which if you know anything about reishi mushrooms, they're really, really great for your health. And it's sad to think that if we didn't have these forests, you know, how many other things we wouldn't have as well.
Yeah, interesting. John, thank you, Brianna. John, a comment?
Yeah, that's a great point. Just a great point. There's so much we don't know about understory species and microorganisms within the soil itself. All of these fantastic relationships of mycorrhizal fungi within forests, this whole idea of a worldwide web of mushrooms connecting trees to other trees and this kind of communication that goes on in these older forests, the mycorrhizal fungi, these thread-like mycelium that attach to tree roots and provide additional water and nutrients to the tree, and then the tree provides photosynthetic material to the fungi. So it's a trade, you know, it's Dow Jones kind of stuff going on. But what's really fascinating in the mushroom community, amongst a lot of things, is that connection of these trees, one to the next, via the whole fungal community. It's fascinating. A whole lot still being learned about this. So, you know, we think we know so doggone much, and we do, but we know fundamentally very little still in a lot of ways about these smaller organisms, fungal organisms, microorganisms, so forth, that are really doing all the work in that forest. And so old growth communities are just that. There's this community of life that is grown together over 300-400 years and longer. Some communities, like Sylvania up in the UP, you know, it's 2,000 to 3,000 years since that had a major disturbance of any kind. So you have these interrelationships that are so long-term that people are still trying to tease out what does that all mean. It's fascinating to me, anyway.
John called in to say earlier that he visited the Wilderness State Park in Michigan, and he said it's a magical place. Reminded him of what we've lost.
Yeah, these are snapshots now of historical frames, photographs in effect. These are relatively small places. In Wisconsin, we don't have one square mile, at least that I am aware of true relic old-growth forest. The best is in the UP. I know it's a Wisconsin radio show, but if you want to go up into the UP, the Porcupine Mountains and the Sylvania Wilderness Recreation Area are two only ecosystem-sized old-growth forests in the Midwest, other than the Boundary Waters Canoe Area over in Minnesota. But what we really want to do, and I hope for through this book, was to bring up the discussion of how do we begin to consolidate some of these state natural area sites into larger units, the 40, 50,000 plus to 100,000 acre sites that are ecosystem size, so we get all these interrelationships taking place. And they're not easily prone to introduced species and deer browsing and so forth and so on. So
yeah. And Jan in Madison will give you a chance. Jan, hi.
Hi. I'm so glad to be on your show. I just wanted to tell a little bit of a story, and then I have a question. In the Madison School Forest, I was a naturalist for several years ago, and they cut down a tree fell, a double trunk white oak tree. One side of it fell, and the DNR dated it in the 1400s. And it's way in the back of the forest, and it's kind of remotely out there. But my question is, because it was a double trunk tree, and there was that a second growth on this white pine or white oak that has grown? And because if that's the case, then the original white oak would be a lot older than in the 1400s.
Gosh, I don't know. Are you talking about the Olson Oak Forest, the Madison School Forest?
Yeah.
It's so interesting. I had not heard that there was one from the 1400s. I had heard back and read about the number of oak trees, in particular from the 1750s, that, you know, once fire was being removed from the landscape, that those were now growing. So, but 1400s, my goodness. And about the double trunks, you know, I don't know if it's right at the ground level that could be two different acorns. It could have grown from the same acorn and maybe been browsed so that the first two branches became then the leader stems and branched off. We have a lot of those kind of goalpost trees in the woods that are a function of browsing. So,
yeah,
can't tell you. Don't know.
Yeah. But thanks for calling, Jan. Just thinking about aging, Rolf and Hayward emailed to ask how you make an age determination of a living tree without harming the tree. He lives in Sawyer County, and they have some very large trees. Given the genetic diversity and all the other factors that could impact growth, is there a way to make a determination without just estimating age?
Yeah, there sure is. And estimating gets you in a whole lot of trouble.
Yeah.
So don't bother trying to do that. Get a tree core. They can be purchased commercially, and it's basically a hollow screw that you turn into the tree and hopefully long enough to reach the center of the tree. Then you twist it back out, and it brings out a core, this kind of a straw-like length of the radius of that particular tree, and then you can count the rings on that very small boring that you've done into the tree.
And there you go. And so it's still a ring counting thing.
It is. That's the only way you can do it. Yeah.
So what's your favorite? You've identified 100 potential, but 50 really good ones and 50 others that are pretty good. What's your favorite of all of them?
Yeah, I was hoping you wouldn't ask me that. too hard, because so many they're all so unique. If I had to tell people to go to one place to see big pines, I would go to Cathedral Pines in Oconee County. There's only a 22-acre site there, but these pines have been cored and are 370 years old. Many of them, or at least a number of them, are 150 feet tall. They're up to 4 foot in diameter. It's one of the probably the best, although very small, stand of white pines we have left on public lands. Menominee Reservation's got tons of big pines, unfortunately not open to the public to wander around in too much. Nearby here, what's always good, I think, is to have easy access, easy hiking trails. There's a site east of Eagle River called the Franklin and Butternut Lakes State Natural Area. It has a beautiful nature trail. It's only a mile long, but it wanders its way through some excellent hemlock and white pine, big old trees, and there's quite an archaeological story there as well, which is fun. So,
yeah, there we go. And I tell you, I wish we have not even begun to scratch the surface of your book, John.
We haven't,
But there is so much good information here, and what a great story you've got to tell. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today, and I hope a lot of people read your book. Thank you, John.
Thanks a million. Appreciate it, Larry.
John Bates is the author, and the title is Our Living Ancestors, The History and Ecology of Old Growth Forests in Wisconsin. and where to find them. Great book by a great writer, John Bates. We're really happy to have him with us. Tomorrow we'll talk about what to do if your children are picky eaters. That's one of the things we'll cover. And in the meantime, I hope you'll stay with us. We have lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us.